Welcome to The Truth Is So Boring. This is part two of our series on a chemical hunger from slimemold.com or slimemoldtimemold.com for Thursday, December 23rd, 2021. So we start off with, if you haven't heard part one, you can find that at thetruthissoboring.org, and you can listen to this without having heard that, but you might have some gaps filled in if you go back and listen to it afterwards. So again, that's thetruthissoboring.org.
Also, highly recommend you check out the original, the website itself, slimemoldtimemold.com, mm-hmm. and reread over it yourself if you feel like you missed something. There's also details that we skipped over in the interest of time, trying mm-hmm. to keep to just the main topics here without going on too many tangents. So there's plenty of information there that we weren't able to go over that is well worth reading.
Mm-hmm. So we need a theory that can account for all of the mysteries we reviewed earlier, and we'll go back over those in a second.
Okay. We need a theory that can account for all of the mysteries we reviewed last time. Another way to put this is to say that, based on evidence, we're looking for a factor that, one, changed over the last 100 years, two, with a major shift around 1980, three, and whatever it is, there's more of it every year, four, it doesn't affect people living non-industrialized lives, regardless of diet,
five, but it does affect lab animals, wild animals, and animals living in zoos. Six, it has something to do with palatable human snack foods, unrelated to nutritional value. Seven, it differs in intensity by altitude for some reason. And eight, it appears to have nothing to do with our diets.
Environmental contamination by artificial human-synthesized compounds fits this picture very well, and no other account does.
Mm-hmm. Mystery number one, this is going back over
in detail.
Just a bit of a summary from last week. Mystery number one was the obesity epidemic itself. People were skinny before the modern era because these contaminants didn't exist back then. People's diets were worse in the past, quote unquote, full of lard and bread, because diet didn't cause obesity. Doesn't cause obesity. Well, didn't and doesn't. The around 1% of people who were obese in the past were people with one of the various medical conditions known to cause obesity, such as Prader-Willi syndrome, hypothyroidism, or hypothalamic lesions.
Mystery 2. An abrupt shift. People rapidly started getting more and more obese starting around 1980 because the contaminants are the product or byproduct of some industrial process. We're looking for compounds that were invented around between 1960 or 70 because it would probably take a few years for enough to get into the environment to start affecting us. Alternatively, these might be the compounds that had been invented much earlier but only began to see widespread deployment around 1980. Either way, we're looking for an abrupt shift.
Mystery 3. The ongoing crisis. The obesity epidemic keeps getting worse because these contaminants continue to be produced and continue to build up in the environment. Every year they accumulate and each of us gets a larger dose. This suggests that we're looking for compounds that don't break down easily, or at least are being introduced into the environment faster than they break down.
Mystery 4. Hunter-gatherers.
My favorite.
Mine too. Different groups of hunter-gatherers that exist today remain lean while eating very different diets because the human body can thrive on many kinds of food.
Different diets from each other.
Some of the diets are extremely high fat. Some of them are extremely high starch. Some of them are extremely high sugar. Some eat an extremely varied diet while others get almost half of their calories from a single food source. But they didn't become obese because they're eating fat right off the Gemsbok or yams straight out of the ground. Shout out to Straight Out the Ground Farms, and living in grass huts. When hunter-gatherers adopt an industrialized lifestyle, however, they become obese, just like anyone else. You'll recall that in 1990, a team led by Stefan Lindeberg traveled to the island of Katava and found that none of the Katavans were obese, despite the fact that they had plenty of foods and ate a very starchy diet.
It's true that none of the Katavans living on the island were at all overweight. But there were actually two overweight Katavans. Both men who had grown up in Katava had since moved away for many years and who happened to be visiting at the time of the study. Lindeberg managed to examine one of them, a 44-year-old businessman named Yutala, who had left the island 15 years earlier to become a businessman in Papua New Guinea.
Papua New Guinea.
Papua New Guinea. I knew somebody who lived there.
Oh, I'm sorry.
At the time of the study, Utala was almost 50 pounds heavier than the average Catawba man of his height, 12 pounds heavier than the next heaviest man, and had the highest blood pressure of any Catawba in Lindeberg examined.
50 pounds heavier.
And had the highest blood pressure.
So, when he moved away from the island, Utala was exposed to a modern way of living. More importantly, he was exposed to the contaminants of an industrialized society. As a result, he became overweight. Utala isn't an isolated case. In fact, this happens with some regularity. Lindeberg notes, an epidemic of obesity and weight gain has occurred in former traditional populations that transitioned to a Western lifestyle, unquote, and cites a total of 17 sources to support this claim, including examples from Sudanese communities, Native Americans, Pacific Islanders, South Australian Aborigines, and the people of Vanuatu.
Wow.
Vanuatu. When humans, this is another quote. When humans switch from an ancient to a Western lifestyle, they experience increased waistlines, reduced insulin sensitivity, higher blood pressure, and a host of related disorders and diseases. End
wow.
quote.
Mystery 5, lab animals and wild animals. Lab animals and wild animals are becoming more obese because they are exposed to the same environmental contaminants that we are. If they are living around humans, in or around our buildings, eating industrially prepared foods or the scraps of such foods, they are exposed to contaminants in the same way as the rest of us. Even if they're not living in close proximity to humans, these compounds are probably in groundwater and drinking water.
Not to mention the air.
Mm.
That's my own addition.
Potentially, yeah.
We're all breathing the same air.
Yeah.
Mystery number 6, palatable human food. Lab rats gain more weight from human foods than they do from rat chow, with similar nutritional properties, because obesity doesn't come from fat or carb content, but from contaminants in the food, and human food has more contaminants than the rat chow does, likely from packaging and processing. Processed foods end up with more contaminants in them. For example, there are 4 times more phthalates in Kraft mac and cheese powders than in block cheese, string cheese, and cottage cheese. Another example are these results from the FDA. This is a link, an inline link in the text, which you can follow if you'd like. As reported by the AP Press, I'm not going to expand those studies, but there's a whole lot of information here supporting this theory.
Doesn't this mean that avoiding packaged and processed food should reverse obesity? We think the answer is maybe. There's not a lot of research on whole foods diets, but the evidence that we do have is quite promising. People seem to lose a reasonable amount of weight and keep it off for up to 12 months when they're eating largely unprocessed plant-based foods. But we should be more skeptical of these results until there are more studies. While this diet lowered almost everyone's BMI, when we look at individual results, most people remained obese or overweight after 12 months on this diet. Similar findings are characteristic of Paleolithic diets.
Ding. Even when the studies are conducted by advocates of these diets, they produce very moderate benefits at best. In one case, causing only 6.6 pounds more weight loss than a comparison diet across a 3-month period.
Hmm. There do happen to be compelling anecdotes. In 2010, Chris Voigt, the executive director of Washington State Potatoes Commission, vowed to eat nothing but 20 plain potatoes and a small amount of cooking oil for 60 days straight to demonstrate the potatoes are perfectly healthy and in fact nutritious enough to sustain a person for quite a while.
This wasn't intended as a weight loss diet. In fact, 20 potatoes per day was the amount he calculated he would need to maintain his weight. It's about 2,200 calories. Despite this, Voigt lost 21 pounds over a 60-day diet. He even had trouble eating enough. He just wasn't very hungry. Why would this happen? Well, unprocessed potatoes are about as raw a food as you can find, and won't pick up contaminants from industrial cooking and packaging. If Voigt was being exposed to contaminants through his everyday diet, then switching to potatoes largely cooked at home would lead him to getting a much lower dose of contaminants.
I have to say, also, like, just eating plain potatoes might be a little less appetizing, so...
Yeah, there's a whole aside that I was reading before we got started recording that's all about a nutrient sludge diet. There was a study in the 1960s, 1965. It's a case study. It's not a proper experiment, but it showed the people that were fed, like, a nutrient diet, like, similar to, like, the rat pressing the lever for a pellet. Like, it was literally you pull a lever and it syringes food into you.
Mm.
They kept track of how much food, how many calories they had, and also their weight. Everyone who was healthy weight ate enough to maintain their weight. All the obese participants ate much less and lost weight during the study.
Hmm.
So something about the palatability definitely also, like, impacts how much we choose to eat.
Hmm.
But, like, only to a certain extent, and also the nutrients. This was in the 1960s, so it's also before all the industrial contaminants, so those people were probably obese because they actually had, like, Prader-Willi syndrome or something. And this is all noted in there. I wasn't even expecting to touch on that, but nutrient sludge is a thing that exists, and it has...
What's a nutrient sludge? Is that like...
It's like Soylent.
Okay, yeah. That's what I thought.
It's basically like lab Soylent. Most people are likely exposed to some of these contaminants in their diet, so eating a diet with fewer contaminants helps. But most people are also likely exposed at home, at work, and through their drinking water and air again, so diet alone can only help so much. All right, go on. Sorry.
Actually, could you continue?
Mystery 7, altitude. Obesity is less common at high altitudes because of the watershed. I wish I had my dinger. Environmental contaminants build up as water flows downhill and are in much higher concentrations as you approach sea level, which obviously if, you know, the lower altitude you're at, the more gravity is going to pull water to you. I mean, that's basic physics. Mm-hmm. For example, and here you should, if you're following along on the website, there's a map here. You can take a look at it. It shows state-by-state obesity levels, and it's from the Center for Disease Control. It's from 2018. It shows like pretty strongly, like places in lower altitudes, like the Mississippi River region is clearly outlined in red as having the highest obesity rate.
And it goes on to say the Mississippi watershed is America's largest drainage basin, covering 41% of the country. If you compare this map to the state-level obesity map of the Mississippi watershed below, you'll see that every single state with the obesity rates of greater than 35% borders on a river from this watershed system. Also informative is that there are three states at the mouth of the river, Mississippi, Arkansas, and Louisiana, and they're number one, number three, and number four in the nation in terms of obesity rate at 39, 37, and 36% respectively.
And there's another map of the actual watershed region if you're interested in more details on that.
Yeah, that's a really cool map.
Yeah, and the next one is my favorite because it's a map of all of the watersheds across the United States, color-coded. It's so cool, and it's very illuminating. Obesity rates are high everywhere in America, but we can see that they are higher in states where the groundwater has covered more distance and had more time to accumulate contaminants. See continental watershed map below. States where groundwater comes from shorter river systems have a clear tendency towards lower, though still in the range of 25 to 30%, rates of obesity. And I want to point out that we live in a watershed region, and I would love to see a comparison of obesity rates in people who drink the spring water versus people who drink the town water, because I have some guesses as to what that data would be.
And the article goes on to cite several examples of similar situations going on in other countries with other watersheds, and that's pretty interesting. It's like China and Iran, and definitely worth a read in the website if you have the time.
There are always a few confusing outliers, of course. Why are Maine, North Dakota, and Alabama so obese? In China, why are Xinjiang and Heilongjiang, I did not say that right, provinces so obese? The answer is that watersheds play a role in the distribution of contaminants, but they are not the whole story. In some cases, though, the answer may come back to watersheds after all. For example, I'm going to mispronounce this, I'm sorry. Xinjiang's province's main watershed is the Tarim Basin, an endorheic basin that captures water and has no outlet. Rain that falls in the Tarim Basin flows to Lop Nor and stays there. The water might evaporate, but any contaminants it carried will stay in the basin. So even though the water only travels a short distance and would seem to be less contaminated, water only comes from the rain, which can easily be contaminated. And
it builds up, it sticks there a while.
Through evaporation, yeah. We see similar trends in data from Iran, like Scott mentioned.
There are obvious and often extreme differences in obesity between people at 0 feet altitude and at 500 feet altitude, both in the U.S. and in other countries. The changes in CO2 aren't enough to make any difference, but water runoff could. It's important to note that altitude itself doesn't affect the obesity directly. Instead, altitude is a proxy for how high an area is in the watershed, which is itself a proxy for how badly the local water supply is contaminated. This is why Mississippi is more obese than low-lying areas of California. In California, the water supply hasn't traveled nearly as far in its path to the ocean, and has traveled past fewer farms, highways, cities, and factories. And I would argue that's probably the case in the New York City as well, due to its proximity to this region.
Yeah, New York City probably shows a lower rate of obesity than it would have if their water wasn't coming from here. I want to make a note also, an observation, if you would. It often is stated that poorer people are more obese.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes, at least informally from what I've noticed looking at maps whenever I've looked for places to live, and I've lived in like five very different geographic regions of the United States, so I think I have some experience in this. It generally follows that the poorer you are, the lower altitude you're going to end up being. That's where the housing is. The higher, you know, estates mm-hmm. and heights and stuff, those are generally more expensive because they have better views, but that, I think, has the other effect of exposing people to, you know, more or less contaminants.
It can, but it doesn't necessarily, which is interesting.
I think that would apply out here, though.
Specifically, interlude I is on well water. I was reading that before we got started, and so that actually plays a role in things, too, is you don't, like, just altitude by itself isn't enough to determine how long your water has been kind of stagnant and underground and stuff like that.
Or like how many contaminants have leached in from the underground, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's more just like how much it could pick up as it travels.
Mm-hmm. So finally we get to mystery number 8. Diets don't work. But finally, no diet will reliably help because obesity isn't caused by a bad diet and can't be cured by a good one.
Can I just butt in again? Because like people turn this into a moral issue, especially when you see you see the data that poor people tend to be more obese, then you might think, well, there's something about poor people that makes them more obese. Maybe they have like less willpower or something. But if diets don't work, then that can't be the case.
Yeah. Yeah, I've actually had people like threaten me for talking about this online, be like, oh yeah, I work out all the time. I'll kick your ass, fatty. Assuming you know my weight, based on the fact that I'm talking about the fact that diets don't cure obesity, despite the fact that I'm you know not really all that large.
Yeah,
it's very funny.
That's a pretty clear display of insecurity if I ever saw one.
Yeah.
Anyway, hypothetically speaking, if there was a person who was only exposed to these contaminants in their food, cutting out the contaminated food for long enough would theoretically cure them. This may be what happened with Chris Voigt when he cut out everything but potatoes.
Ultimately, the fact that diets don't work very well for most people suggests that we pick up these contaminants from other sources than just food. Perhaps, probably they are also, to varying degrees, in our water, our workplaces, our homes, our air, and yeah, it's our food too.
I also like want to point out that the effects of aerosolized vinyl, which is often vinyl, if you know like what vinyl smells like, then you've been exposed to vinyl in the air. And
I don't know if I do.
It's kind of a sweet smell. It bioaccumulates and can cause other I don't really know actually. I'd have to look it up. I know it's carcinogenic, and it might also play a role in the obesity epidemic. I'll look into it. But the fact is, a lot of people's houses use vinyl siding that off-gas vinyl, and generally, like it's a low-cost thing, so more poor people use it, so more poor people are exposed to it.
Hmm. Wow. Before we go on, I just wanted to go back and kind of sum up the point of this whole blog post here. Only one theory can account for all the available evidence. The obesity epidemic is caused by one or more environmental contaminants. These contaminants are the only cause of the obesity epidemic. The worldwide increase in obesity rates since 1980 is entirely attributable to their effects. For any two people in a group, the difference between their weight is largely genetic, because everyone is exposed to similar levels of contamination. But the difference between the average weight in 1980 and the average weight today is the result of environmental contaminants.
3.3. Contamination. We aren't the first researchers who are concerned about environmental contaminants and the role they might play in rising obesity rates. But the scope of this inquiry has traditionally been limited to how contaminants might contribute to the obesity epidemic.
Hmm.
One review focuses on food additives, both intentional, like artificial sweeteners or colorers, and unintentional, like pesticides. suggesting that, quote, environmental contaminants are contributing to the global epidemic of obesity, end quote, and suggests that the review will be helpful in elucidating their role in the obesity epidemic. Another review focused on endocrine-disrupting chemicals, but closes by saying, public health officials should think of the obesity epidemic as a function of a multifactorial complex of events, including environmental endocrine disruptors, end quote. Yet another mentions nutrient quality, stress, fetal environment, and pharmaceutical or chemical exposure as relevant contributing influences.
Oh, this is totally not in this at all. It's just something I read somewhere else. Apparently, if we eat the same food as we did 50 years ago, like, you know, for just an arbitrary example, like an apple from today, it'll contain most of the time less nutrients than one from 40 years ago because of the quality of the soil having degraded in industrial farms.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if an apple is a good example. I think a carrot might be a better one. But
Yeah. Apples, like, do a lot of self-fertilizing with their leaves.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, like carrots, corn. Corn
might have been what it was that I was thinking of having read specifically. For some reason, bananas is in my head, and I knew that couldn't be right because we didn't have the same bananas 40 years ago.
Well, also because bananas have to be hyper-fertilized and, like, don't grow in America.
Anyway, canaries in the coal mine documents a rise in obesity in wild and captive animals and suggests that the...
Etiology,
that's A-E-T-I-O, that's... Okay. Of etiology of increasing body weight may involve several as of yet unidentified and or poorly understood factors. What factors? What factors could these be? They list a couple. Viral pathogens, epigenetic factors, and at the very end of the paper, the collection of endocrine-disrupting chemicals widely present in the environment. A statement from the Second International Workshop on Obesity and Environmental Contaminants in Uppsala, Sweden... Uppsala, Sweden, concluded that the findings of numerous numerous animal and epidemiological studies are consistent with the hypothesis that environmental contaminants could contribute to the global obesity epidemic.
A national toxicology program and workshop from 2012 suggests that exposures to environmental chemicals may be contributing factors to the epidemics of diabetes and obesity. They suggest that there is a link between some forms of contamination and type 2 diabetes, but overall they say that there is still not enough research to draw firm conclusions.
Despite this interest, all the claims have been quite mild, identifying environmental contaminants as possibly being one of many factors contributing in some small way to the obesity epidemic. In contrast, we propose that the obesity epidemic is entirely driven by environmental contaminants. The entire difference in obesity between 1980 and today is attributable to one or more contaminants that we are exposed to in our food, water, and living spaces.
Still, not everyone today is obese. I struggled with being underweight, personally. There are two reasons for this. First of all, even though everyone is exposed, some people are exposed to more than other people. As I was talking about, you know, being poor and generally having to live
in the water table because floodplains are cheaper, real estate. Some people are also less affected by these contaminants than other people, even at the same dose, and this difference is largely genetic. Even these people probably still, on average, have more body fat than their ancestors did. Hunter-gatherers have BMIs around 22 or 23. Civil War veterans in the 1890s had average BMIs of around 23 as well. If your BMI is higher than 23, you're probably fatter than you would be without the action of these contaminants. Sometimes it is these factors in combination. If you have a genetic resistance and you're exposed to low levels of these contaminants, you'll be much less obese than average. We're at 3.4 now. Further evidence in favor of contaminants.
The difference in obesity rates between countries, which is that's an inline citation. You can look at it, the data directly from there, if you go to the Slime Old Time Old website. The difference in obesity rates between countries, as well as the differences between states or provinces within a country, is also the result of differences in contamination. Some of it will be genetic, but some of it is because some places are more contaminated than others. This makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the strongest evidence for this comes from immigration. When they arrive in a new country, immigrants usually have lower obesity rates than their native counterparts do. But over time, they become about as obese as those natives are. Looking at the trends, it appears that much of the effect of the contaminants occurs in the first year of exposure, though it takes 10 to 15 years before immigrants have obesity rates similar to the rates in the host country.
During the Cuban economic crisis, known as the Special Period, I'm sure that sounded better in Spanish. Obesity rates plummeted from 14% obese to 7% obese. Normally, this is attributed to the decrease in calorie consumption and an increase in exercise, as oil shortages led people to drive less and walk or bike more. But we already know that reducing consumption and increasing exercise have very modest effects on weight loss.
The average Cuban lost about 20 pounds in just a couple of years, even though in 1993, 2 years into the crisis, the average Cuban was still eating a very reasonable 2,099 calories per day. Hmm. I want to emphasize that during the special period, people were not starving in Cuba, despite what your state propaganda might have told you.
Might have. I never heard anything about it. That's probably the more effective state propaganda.
People tend to make assumptions also that, like, mm-hmm. shortages go with famines. Food was restricted, but very few people were starving. While obesity dropped from 14 to 7%, the number of people listed as underweight only went from 8% to 10.3%. And there's a nice little handy chart with all those details, again, if you'd like to take a look. And it's not like they were all eating very healthy. The primary sources of energy during the crisis were sugarcane and rice.
Oh, man. Sweetened rice. Okay.
Hey, that can be really tasty. You should try mochi sometime.
All right.
Rarely mentioned, but particularly notable, is that food imports virtually ceased during this period. If we assume that a Cuban obesity was partially a result of contaminants in their food imports, this explains the data perfectly. Alternatively, we can note that fertilizer and pesticide use sharply declined in this period as well, as both were normally derived from oil, which the island was now seriously lacking. These are also potential contaminants.
One surprising fact is that the most obese countries in the world by BMI are all tiny island nations in the South or Central Pacific.
Ding, ding.
Depending on the year and the source, the 10 most obese nations in the world are usually small Pacific islands. Obesity rates in the countries are not merely high, they are clear outliers. The most obese mainland nations are around 35 to 40% obese, but these small Pacific islands have obesity rates in the range of 45 to 60%. Certainly this requires some sort of explanation.
To begin with, there are some reasons to suspect that this is largely an artifact. These islands all have very small populations and are genetically homogenous, so it's possible that much of the difference is genetic. Polynesians also appear to be slightly stouter and more muscular than other groups, which may mean that BMI is an especially bad measure for this group and leads us to slightly overestimate how obese they actually are. With a better measure of obesity, their obesity rates might be more similar to the rates of other very obese countries like Kuwait and the United States. And I've heard countless stories of, like, people having, like, just, you know, weird body dimensions and thus being declared obese. I might not actually be underweight because of my body dimensions, but I am considered underweight medically because of how much I weigh versus how tall I am. Muscle weighs like 5 times as much as fat, and if you have more muscle than fat on your body, the BMI is going to be thrown off because it's too simplistic.
In addition, Polynesian countries import most of their food and eat a lot of highly processed canned meat, famously Spam, which may be more contaminated than average. It's also notable that the Nauru, who the most obese 61% country in the world, have been heavily strip mined for phosphate.
Ding 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 ding
this
ding ding.
This is interesting because the mining of the major This is interesting because mining is a major source of environmental contamination. For comparison, West Virginia is an obesity outlier in the United States, and it too has a long history of strip mining. In any case, this is why Nauru imports so much food. With about 80% of the island strip mined, they can't grow anything there. Most of these islands are not so heavily mined, of course, but this might explain why Nauru is 61% obese and Samoa is only, quote-unquote, 47% obese. All right, moving on. We're on part four. We're reading from part four now.
Of A Chemical Hunger by Slime Mold Time Mold.
Yeah, that's what we're doing. Evidence strongly suggests that the obesity epidemic is the result of environmental contaminants. However, it's not entirely clear which contaminants are responsible. If we're lucky, a few compounds are entirely responsible for the increase in obesity over the last 40 years, and we can ban those chemicals. If we're not lucky, the obesity epidemic is the result of dozens or even hundreds of different contaminants, each with a small effect, which, when combined, lead to extreme obesity. In our case, we can try to ban or regulate them all, but it would be much more difficult to find ways to get all of them out of our food, water, homes, air, etc. While work While more work will be needed to pin down exactly what contaminants are responsible, we can make some very educated guesses because we already know what kind of contaminants we're looking for.
4.1, invention and introduction. The big inflection point for the obesity epidemic, as we have said multiple times, was around 1980, so we should be looking for compounds that entered the environment slightly before then. Either they were discovered around 1960 or 1970 and were immediately introduced, or they were discovered sometime before and then went into widespread use just before 1980.
Mm-hmm.
These contaminants may be synthetic. I'm going to add a third one in there that, like, they might have just taken a long time to accumulate. Literally to bioaccumulate, and like now we're finally seeing the trophic results of stuff that we've been using for like a couple hundred years. It's probably all of the above.
I think that with how abrupt the shift is, that I think they're probably not wrong in suggesting that it's something at least in the latter half of the 19th or the 20th century. Probably not earlier than that.
Okay, these contaminants may be synthetic, but they don't have to be. They could also be naturally occurring compounds that are introduced into the environment through human activity. A clear example that I have in my head is fracking, which pulls up groundwater and all kinds of stuff. Fracking isn't the greatest example because they're also pumping chemicals into the water, but drilling for wells, strip mining, all of that stuff. Any type of mining.
Just oil drilling in general is probably is definitely one of the things that they talk about.
Generally, resource extraction tends to like dredge up, and I use the word dredge intentionally, either contaminants that were previously like just hanging out and maybe not so prevalent, or covered by dirt or something, and also introduce new contaminants directly to ground and groundwater.
Mm-hmm. We're aware that correlation doesn't imply causation by itself, showing that the time course of some contaminant is related to an upward trend in obesity rates isn't enough to show that the contaminant is responsible for the obesity epidemic, but it is suspicious. We should keep in mind that the link between smoking and lung cancer was largely established through correlational data.
If we don't see a relationship between a contaminant and the obesity epidemic, it's harder to make the case for that particular contaminant. For example, some people have proposed that certain milk proteins might be behind the obesity epidemic, but if you look at dairy consumption by country, you immediately see that some of the leanest countries are near the top, and many of the most obese countries are near the bottom. As a result, we don't think this is a serious candidate, and we don't discuss it in this paper. A relationship is one of the first signs we should look for in a proposed explanation, even though by itself, it's not enough to be convincing. It's a clue. We're looking for clues.
Section 4.2, between group differences. There are large differences in rates of obesity between counties, states, countries, and even professions. Some of this is due to differences in factors like altitude or genetics. For example, in a group of about 43,500 patients from the San Francisco Bay Area, the rate of obesity in European Americans was around 26%, but the rate of obesity among Asian Americans was much lower at 12%. This also differed quite a bit by country of origin. Among Asian Americans, Filipino Americans, 24%, and Indian Americans, 17%, were among the most obese, and Chinese Americans at 7%, and Vietnamese Americans were the least obese. This suggests that even if these environmental contaminants were just as widespread in China as they are in the United States, the rate of obesity would be only at about 7%. In this light, it's not surprising that the rate of obesity in China is currently around 6%. This isn't a mystery that we need to explain. It's about what we would expect based on what we know of genetics of obesity. Despite this, some of the difference in obesity rates between countries is probably due to differences in exposure to contaminants. This is something we should keep an eye out for. In contrast to China, Indian Americans are about 17% obese, less obese than European Americans, but much more obese than people living in India, who are only about 4% obese.
4.3, dose dependence.
This is interesting, but kind of in the weeds.
This is actually one of the more... Well, okay, 4.4 I think is really my favorite part, which is interactions. Mm-hmm. I like the complicated stuff, but we're cracking open the easy ones first and getting progressively more complex as we go on, so bear with us. And also, if you feel like adding me, or I'm sure mold_time at Twitter themselves would be okay with answering questions as well.
There's also a comment section at the bottom of these where they do answer questions and interact with people who have comments on this.
Okay, so yeah, leave a comment for them. You can ask me too, but I'd prefer if you ask them. An obvious smoking gun would be if the amount of exposure to a contaminant were related to obesity. If people who are exposed to a high dose of the contaminant are fatter than those who are exposed to a low dose, that would be a strong indication that the contaminant is responsible, right?
Well, maybe. We are all living in a fattening environment. A 2012 meta-analysis of 115 studies concluded that about 75% of individual difference in BMI is genetic. This is entirely compatible with the idea that contaminants are responsible for the difference in obesity rates between 1970 and 2020. It just means that, now that everyone has been exposed to more or less the same contaminants, 75% of the population, of the variation in the population, is genetic. That leaves only 25% of the variance to potentially be explained. If we assume that all of the variance is due to differences in dose, then some simple math tells us that the correlation with dose would be R equals 0.5. I think that's a ratio. This is a reasonably large correlation, but we also shouldn't expect things to be so simple. If we expect that there are 10 contaminants, the correlation between dose and BMI for each would be around a ratio of 0.16.
I'm going to look that up and make sure it's ratio, because that's a statistics
I tried looking it up, and I could not find an explanation of it. If you do, I would appreciate it. If the dose explains only 15% of the remaining variance rather than 25%, leaving a reasonable 10% as a result of noise, the correlation for each of the contaminants would only be 0.12.
Okay.
Or, you know, I would say that, like, you know, there might be some that are more or less dose dependent, so looking at differences in doses would explain, you know, this is like an average. It would probably explain like 0.12. You have something to say?
I do. I figured out what R was.
Okay.
R is the variable that represents the correlation coefficient. The correlation coefficient is a statistical term that measures the strength and direction of a linear relationship between two variables on a scatter plot.
Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what I was thinking it was. I just didn't really have the words to put it. Thank you for phrasing that.
This is on the For Dummies website, so I'll just throw that at you, and we can throw it in the notes so that anyone else who is having trouble with some of the statistical stuff can get some help without
Thanks.
Needing to bother them or us about it.
That's useful. I was actually thinking of bothering them about it, so thank you for answering that for me.
So, let's see. Positive numbers indicate uphill linear relationships. Negative numbers indicate downhill linear relationships. And of course, the size of the number is it demonstrates the strength of the correlation
on a scale of like negative 1 to 1, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, on a scale of like 0 to 1, it would be like, I guess, 12% the correlation strength that you'd have there. And that's, with a large enough sample size, it would certainly be detectable, but dose alone almost certainly can't explain the remaining variance. We should be aware that even if there is a strong dose-dependent effect, the effect size might appear statistically to be quite small.
At some point in the past, these contaminants weren't in the environment at all, or barely. I mean, I want to say, like, natural contaminants, again, that are, like, you know, underground for a long time, and then mm-hmm. we accidentally crack them open by fracking or drilling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those count as contaminants too, but they're not human-made. They're just human disturbed.
In so doing, they become you know, more highly concentrated than they would be otherwise.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now they're so widespread that almost everyone in the industrialized world is getting a dose. Almost. This means we're working with a restricted range. When the range of a variable is restricted, the correlation always ends up looking smaller than it really is.
Mm-hmm.
That link leads to a paper, that was an inline link in what we're reading, leads to a paper where they show that for a data set with a true correlation of R of 0.82, positive, with different range restrictions, the apparent correlation can become or look like 0.51, 0.47, or even as small as 0.18. In some cases, a restricted range can even make a positive correlation appear to be negative. And again, if you go to the website, slimeoldtimeold.com, they posted this scatter plot, and you can look at it mm-hmm. with all the different ranges highlighted to demonstrate exactly like how this happens.
Mm-hmm.
So if this isn't translating very well audio, go to heading 4.3 and just scroll down until you see that scatter plot if you want to review it yourself. So we know that in most samples, everyone will have similar levels of exposure to the contaminants. We'll be working with a restricted range, and any correlation we see will be smaller than the true correlation. It's not clear how restricted our range is, but the correlation we see may be much smaller than the true relationship. It might disappear altogether, or even appear slightly negative. And remember, if genetics is 75% of variance, then the largest dose dependence correlation we can expect to see is only 0.5, which is not all that large to begin with.
One pattern you might expect to find is that dose-dependent effects only become apparent in samples with a wide range of doses, that is, in cases where the range isn't restricted. They might be especially pronounced in groups that have extremely high levels of exposure, such as people who work with these contaminants directly, because that increases the range of dosages.
There might also be diminishing returns. Let's imagine that today, people on average get a dose of 100 units. Back in 1970, everyone got a dose of 0 units. Now, the first 20... And this is units of contamination. This is just a general thought experiment. This isn't like...
Some arbitrary contaminant being exposed to, you know... So the idea is that the first 20% of the contamination might have been very fattening, but in general, the human body can only get so fat. After the first 20 units, you might gain 20 pounds on average, but the next 20 units make you only gain 10 pounds, and the next 20 units make you only gain 5 pounds. Now that everyone is at 100 units, every additional unit of exposure leads to a nearly undetectable change in body mass.
We don't know that there is diminishing weight gain from greater doses of these contaminants, but diminishing returns are pretty common in pharmacology. Lots of examples are presented. If there are diminishing returns, we may be near or past the ceiling effect, in which case we might not be able to detect a dose-dependent effect at all. If this were the case, however, we might expect to see dose-dependent effects in samples with lower than average doses, perhaps samples from the 80s or the 90s, or samples from developing countries which don't yet have doses in the same range as industrialized countries.
A further complication is that being exposed to contaminants doesn't make you gain weight that very same day. Even if on olanzapine, which makes people gain an average of 13.7 kilograms after 48 weeks, you generally don't see your first kilogram of weight gain until after 8 weeks. The dose in your system today will be less correlated with your weight than the dose you were on 6 months ago. The dose will be a lagging factor,
A
lagging indicator. Factor works too.
Okay.
And this will also reduce any correlation.
This is further complicated by the fact that these compounds might have paradoxical reactions, which is what we call it when a drug sometimes has the opposite of its normal effect. Think of someone, like everyone has heard a story of a pet who was given anxiety medication and went into a rage, or a person who has had the same experience. That is a paradoxical reaction because you would expect them to be relaxed. And of course, the driver of that is ultimately release of inhibition. Is one of the biggest effects of anxiolytic medications, and might have been inhibiting a lot of rage.
I think an easier way to say that would be just an angry drunk.
Fair enough. This would cause some portion of people to actually lose weight, and would further reduce the apparent correlation between the contaminant and obesity.
Finally, there are a priori reasons for us not to expect that there should be strong correlations in the existing literature. If there were a compound or contaminant that was correlated with BMI, even a relatively small correlation like R equals 0.2, someone probably would have noticed. That means that either, one, the contaminants are compounds we don't usually measure, so no data set exists where we can compare them to measures of obesity, or, two, the relevant contaminants are commonly measured, but for statistical reasons like the ones above, there isn't an obvious correlation with obesity. Evidence of a dose-dependent relationship would be a smoking gun in favor of contaminant being one of the causes of the obesity epidemic, but the lack of a dose-dependent relationship isn't evidence against the contaminant being involved.
4.4. Environmental interactions. In the following sections, we do our best to identify which of the contaminants we're putting into the environment could be the cause of the obesity epidemic, and we believe that we have found some likely candidates. Unfortunately, this search is complicated by the fact that chemistry and biology allow for bewildering interactions and sometimes seem to be working against us. There are two general ways this can happen. The first is that when chemical contaminants end up in the environment, they can be transformed into different compounds. This can occur as the result of interactions with minerals in the groundwater, from exposure to sunlight, exposure to radioactivity, heat, cold, or from chemical interactions with other contaminants. Since contaminants can sit in soil and groundwater for decades, there's a lot of time for these transformations to happen.
In her book Silent Spring, Rachel Carson describes how contaminants pass mysteriously by underground streams until they emerge and, through the alchemy of air and sunlight, combine into new forms that kill vegetation, sicken cattle, and work unknown harm on those who drink from once pure wells. She provides a few illustrative examples. One case involved a manufacturing plant in Colorado. In 1943, Rocky Mountain Arsenal of the Army Chemical Corps began to use the plant, located near Denver, to manufacture war materials. After 8 years, the same manufacturing plant used to make these war materials was leased to a private oil company for the production of insecticides. Even before this point, however, there were already reports from miles away of mysterious sicknesses in livestock, crops dying and turning yellow, and even human illnesses, possibly related. A thorough investigation eventually revealed that the groundwater between the arsenal and the farms had become contaminated, but it had propagated so slowly that it took several years for the contamination to reach the farmland.
Analysis of the farm's shallow wells revealed contamination with arsenic, chlorides, and other dangerous substances. This was enough to explain the majority of reports of illness and crop damage, but most mysterious was the discovery of the weed killer 2,4-D in some of the wells. Certainly its presence was enough to account for the damage to crops irrigated with this water, but the mystery lay in the fact that no 2,4-D had been manufactured at the arsenal at any stage of its operations. After long and careful study, the chemists at the plant concluded that the 2,4-D had been formed spontaneously in the open basins. It had been formed there from other substances discharged from the arsenal in the presence of air, water, and sunlight, and quite without the invention or intervention of human chemists, the holding ponds had become chemical laboratories for the production of a new chemical, a chemical fatally damaging to much of the plant life it touched. And so the story of the Colorado farms and their damaged crops assumes a significance that transcends its local importance. What other parallels may there be, not only in Colorado, but wherever chemical pollution finds its way into public waters? In lakes and streams everywhere, in the presence of catalyzing air and sunlight, what dangerous substances may be born of parent chemicals labeled harmless?
Yeah, wow. While we can try to identify the contaminants that cause obesity, the disturbing fact is that these contaminants responsible may be compounds we're unfamiliar with because they weren't created in a lab and have never been examined for safety. Again, Rachel Carson puts it better than we could.
Indeed, one of the most alarming aspects of the chemical pollution of water is the fact that here, in river or lake or reservoir, or for that matter, in the glass of water served at your dinner table, are mingled chemicals that no responsible chemist would think of combining in his laboratory. The possible interactions between these freely mixed chemicals are deeply disturbing to officials of the U.S. Public Health Service, who have expressed the fear that the production of harmful substances from comparatively innocuous chemicals may be taking place on quite a wide scale. The reactions may be between two or more chemicals, or between chemicals and the radioactive wastes that are being discharged into our rivers in ever-increasing volume. Under the impact of ionizing radiation, some rearrangement of atoms could easily occur, changing the nature of the chemicals in a way that is not only predictable,
unpredictable,
but beyond our control.
To make matters worse, something quite similar can happen inside our bodies. As surprising and chaotic as the interactions between contaminants can be, their interactions with human biochemistry can be even more complicated. A human being, writes Carson, unlike a laboratory animal living under rigidly controlled conditions, is never exposed to one chemical alone. Between the major groups of insecticides, and between them and other chemicals, there are interactions that have serious potentials. Whether released into the soil, or water, or man's blood, these unrelated chemicals do not remain segregated. There are mysterious and unseen changes by which one alters the power of another for harm. She goes on to describe several such interactions in gory detail.
The organic phosphates, quote, those poisoners of the nerve-protected enzyme cholinesterase, and, quote, become much more dangerous if a person has previously been exposed to chlorinated hydrocarbons that injure the liver. Pairs of different organic phosphates themselves can also interact with each other, quote, in such a way as to increase their toxicity 100-fold, end quote. And that is not an exaggeration, that is an observed statistic. Mm-hmm. Organic phosphates also have the potential to interact with all sorts of other things in the environment, including prescription drugs, synthetic materials, and food additives.
Similarly, a person exposed to DDT is much worse off if they have already been exposed to another hydrocarbon that causes liver damage. So widely used as solvents, paint removers, degreasing agents, dry cleaning fluids, and anesthetics. As a result, a dose of DDT that is survivable for one person may be devastating to someone else. The effect of a chemical of supposedly innocuous nature can be drastically changed by the action of another, Carson tells us. One of the best examples is a close relative of DDT called methoxychlor.
Because it doesn't accumulate in the body to any great extent when given alone, we are told that methoxychlor is a safe chemical, but that is not necessarily true. If the liver has been damaged by another agent, methoxychlor is stored in the body at 100 times its normal rate, and will then imitate the effects of DDT with long-lasting effects on the nervous system. Yet the liver damage that brings this about might be so slight as to pass unnoticed. It might have been the result of any of a number of commonplace situations. Using another insecticide, using a cleaning fluid containing carbon tetrachloride, taking one of the so-called tranquilizing drugs, a number of which, but not all, are chlorinated hydrocarbons and possess power to damage the liver.
Another good example is malathion, an insecticide that at the time was commonly used by gardeners. The name of the product sounds so evil because we're surprised. The name of the product sounds so evil that we're surprised it passed a review of corporate public relations people, but apparently the name comes from the smell and means bad sulfur. So there you go. Malathion is extremely deadly and extremely deadly to insects, but is quote-unquote safe for mammals, including humans. But malathion is only safe because the mammalian liver detoxifies it with an enzyme, rendering it harmless. If, however, this is a quote, something destroys this enzyme and interferes with its action, we are warned, the person exposed to malathion receives the full force of the poison. Unfortunately for all of us, opportunities for this sort of thing to happen are legion.
In particular, Carson relates the story of how a team from the FDA found that when malathion was administered at the same time as some of the other organic phosphates, quote, a massive poisoning results, up to 50 times as severe as would be predicted on the basis of adding together the toxicities of the two, end
Fun.
Quote. This led them to test the combination of many different organic phosphates and found that many pairs of these combinations are exceedingly dangerous in combination. I want to add my own little note here, especially in the days... especially nowadays when careers are less of a thing and job hopping is more of a thing. If you're poor, you may be exposed to like more of this stuff on average simply because you've been working in different places. A mechanic who has been exposed to these to some hydrocarbons through the, just fixing cars and touching grease then goes on to be to work for
with
like
pesticides
yeah
or something like
I was
that.
Gonna say like
oh
like
my
a
God.
Pest
yeah the
control.
Interaction there could be disastrous
yeah. And I'm sure there are plenty of people that are probably suffering from these things that just never thought to get it checked or don't have the money to because our healthcare system is so ridiculously backwards.
Or, like, are fully aware of the fact that they got sick and, you know, maybe, like, I could totally see people getting cancer and died from that sort of interaction.
Absolutely. And, like, there's a lot of this stuff that, like, never mind.
Yeah.
The reason for this appears to be potentiation. Ooh, this is a word I love to use. The reason for this appears to be potentiation of their combined action when one of the compounds destroys the liver enzyme responsible for detoxifying the other. Can I talk for a second about potentiation?
I guess.
Okay. Potentiation is a very familiar term to me because it is often used in pharmacology to describe the amplifying effects of medication on each other. This is not the same as additive effect, which is to say, like, two of a similar class of drug, like a benzo plus alcohol equals extra CNS depression.
Or, you know, you take a Tylenol and an ibuprofen at the same time for a really bad headache or something.
I don't think I would classify that as the same, because those are not the same type of drug.
No, but they do have an additive effect.
But that's not the same as the additive effect that is described by taking the two types of the same class of drug.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Potentiation is taking two different drugs, one of which, usually by blocking the enzyme that lets your body process it, it leads to an increase in blood plasma and effect of the other one.
Like,
so,
like how if you eat mango before you smoke weed, then it makes the high last longer or whatever.
Well, yeah, my reference was more towards MAOIs and SSRIs, with the combination of which can cause serotonin syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, MAOIs inhibit the enzymes that break down and recirculate your neurotransmitter serotonin, and SSRIs also do that. Okay, no, MAOIs do it in the liver, SSRIs do it in the brain, and the combined effect of the two leads to a much higher amount of the blood in your or the drug in your system, and a much greater effect overall that is much greater than the additive effect that you would have by taking two SSRIs or two MAOIs. So, the two need not be given simultaneously, we are warned. The hazard exists not only for the man who may spray this week with one insecticide and next week with another. It exists also for the consumer of sprayed products. The common salad bowl may easily present a combination of organic phosphate insecticides. Residues well within the legally permissible limits may interact. The full scope of the dangerous interaction of chemicals is as yet little known, but disturbing findings now come regularly from scientific laboratories, end quote. I'm really disappointed that we didn't do more, like, quality testing and stuff on these things when we first invented them.
Yeah. Carson relates several more stories, several more examples in a similar vein. Malathion also appears to become more or less dangerous when a person is exposed to certain plasticizing agents. Just like its combination with other organic phosphates, this is because it inhibits the liver enzyme that would normally would draw the teeth of the poisonous insecticide. Similarly, exposure to malathion seems to increase the effect of certain prescription drugs, including muscle relaxants and barbiturates.
I wonder if malathion also does that for alcohol, which is, again, the same type of drug as your muscle relaxants and barbs. Like,
interesting.
Yeah. In addition, we found that malathion can, under some conditions, transform into malaxon. Malaxon. Which is 61 times more deadly.
Oh, God.
One of these conditions is when malathion is exposed to chlorine, as it might be in drinking water.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Everybody has... Well, I mean, everybody who has city water has chlorine in their water.
Everyone who's... I don't know if Roxbury... I don't think Roxbury used to chlorinate their water.
I don't know.
I don't know, because I drink from a well up here, and the only time I drank Roxbury water was, like, either when I was at someone's house or in school.
I don't think you'd necessarily know with the amount to which they chlorinate water in taps. I'm sure that they'd used chlorine in the water treatment whenever we were living in Pittsburgh, but it's not like you could taste it.
I could taste it at some points. Our concern, well, that's only because I'm used to, again, non-chlorinated water. Our concern in this paper isn't the toxicity of different insecticides, of course. The point is that the contaminants that cause obesity may not have a straightforward profile. It's possible that two or more well-known and relatively safe contaminants combine in groundwater to form an unknown new contaminant that causes weight gain and a host of other problems. It's possible that a single contaminant becomes something else entirely when it is exposed to sunlight in fields, ponds, and rivers. It's possible that there are two contaminants, neither of which cause obesity in isolation, but which in combination overwhelm the body.
Well, I think that about wraps up part two for our series on this. Of course, that's part three and four of the actual paper series that we're looking at, the blog series, available at slimemoldtimemold.com. In the blog that they have there, they have several more parts after this and some interludes where they propose some contaminants that they think might be responsible for the obesity epidemic.
We'll dive into that 2 weeks after this broadcast.
Well, I don't know if we're going to do part three in 2 weeks or four, because I might want to do another episode in between like we did last time. I don't know whether we're going to cover the individual different compounds. I kind of want to just present the idea. But if you'd like, we could probably go over... I know lithium was an interesting case, and well water and stuff like that. I'd like to maybe perhaps wrap this up with the conclusion in 2 or 4 weeks, and we'll see how things go in our, you know, continuing to read this. And
I think it might take four.
It might. It might. We'll see.
And as always, if there's anything in particular that you, the listener, would like to hear us talk more about with regard to the obesity epidemic, or if you have questions or are confused about something, you can find us on Twitter at Catamount Commie and at D. Scott Boggs. You can also are we giving our emails?
No, we have a matrix contact info on our website at thetruthissoboring.org.
And if you have questions for Slime Mold, Time Mold, they have a comment section on their website, and they are very responsive, as long as you are polite.
And they have a Twitter as well, at mold_time. You can, again, find the past episodes of this, part one of this. If you want to listen to this again, you can find that at thetruthissoboring.org. You can find our other podcast at donotlearntocode.org. And we're here every Friday as well from 2 to 4 for Cat's Chill to help everyone kick off a relaxing weekend.
Except for this Friday, which...
Right. Yes, I've been told that Mike and Shelley are going to be covering for us this Friday. And, you know, in 2 weeks, tune into The Truth Is So Boring on WIOX Radio 91.3 FM at 9 a.m.
And WIOXradio.org. That's at 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time for anyone who's listening from elsewhere.
Interesting point. I think that does it. See you next time.